Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome to the CollectingCars.com podcast with Chris Harris and Edward Lovett.
Hello and welcome to this episode of the Collecting Cars podcast. Today with myself and Edward Lovett, at Edward Lovett that is, Mr. Richard Porter, otherwise known as Sniff Petrol. Richard is, well, he's our industry's chief satirist and also script writer for Top Gear, the television show, and also, latterly, the Grand Tour. And we disagree about a lot of things. We agree about some things, so this should be quite punchy and fun. He is at Sniff Petrol on Twitter, at Sniff underscore Petrol on Instagram, because someone nicked the tag there, and he's a bit angry about that. But otherwise, any other stuff that you want to be called?
I've been called a lot of things, but I don't want to be called them.
By Tesla. Okay, first of all, great to have you here. Thank you for coming along. We're both a bit sore in the head because he had a few beers last night, and so did I, separately. So if we start to get
ranty... I have wine, Christopher, because I'm a grown-up now.
If we start to get ranty and angry, I apologise, or it could make it even better. We'll see what happens. Sniff Petrol, then. Look, everyone wants to know the genesis of that hasn't read your book. But if you read your book, then you'll know.
Yeah.
But not everyone has.
Yeah, what, you mean my book and On That Bombshell?
That's the one.
Behind the scenes on Top Gear.
Available from all good bookstores.
And some fairly terrible ones as well. mostly charity shops these days, I'd imagine, because it's been out for a couple of years, 3 years now.
It was a big seller in Poland, wasn't it?
It was translated into Polish, and that's the only promo stuff I did. I went and did an appearance in a bookshop in Warsaw and signed books and did a Q&A. They sent a photographer and everything. There's some pictures of me signing books like a proper author. It's one of the proudest things I've ever done because I just went, oh, look at me pretending to be a writer.
This is the thing about disruptors like you, because when you appeared on the scene, you were the renegade, but you were a faceless renegade. We didn't know who you were. I remember sitting in the Autocar office, I don't know, it was 99, 2000, or maybe it was around then or after that, I can't be sure. And someone said, have you seen this? And I was, it was quite late at night. The internet was still, you know, dial-up speeds. So someone said, type in sniffpetrol.com. So as the whirly wheel of death spiraled away on my black and white Mac, I thought, well, this might happen. And this thing came up on the screen with a very, very basic but memorable graphic of a sort of petrol pump handle. Mm-hmm. And the story was Steve Crapley's Motoring Week. This was a parody of Autocar journalist Steve Cropley's Motoring Week, and rather than brilliantly having changed, they brilliantly changed the name to Crapley rather than Cropley, and Motoring Week was spelled W-E-A-K. And this was, it was so impish and naughty. It took the piss out of, you know, a beloved industry figure in a way that we hadn't seen before. And of course, what we did was we watched it, we read it, we tittered with laughter until weeks later, it was us that were the butt of the joke, and we didn't know who this bloke was.
I don't remember ever doing you. I'll let you into a secret, though, that the Steve Crapley's Motoring Week, I didn't write most of that. I can't tell you who did, but it was somebody else sent it to me. Someone I know. I think you might know as well.
I'm sure I do.
And it was so perfect. I only changed a few things and added a little bit in, but the bit that got me that I definitely didn't write was because I just thought it was a perfect satire on the way that, that Steve Cropley still writes his Week in Motoring, whatever it's actually called, was the thing where it was something about... reminded me of when car parts were delivered to factories on trains. Of course, it's all the other way around these days. And it's just like, it just doesn't make any sense, but it's just that sort of slightly wistful nostalgia thing that I just went, that's perfect. But I didn't write that.
Does Steve Crapley still write?
Yes, well, no. That was a one-off. Of course, I'd never met...
Probably still a columist.
And I'd never met him. Now I've met him quite a few times, and I know him a little bit, and he's a really lovely guy, and I would never do that because I feel so guilty.
He's one of the greats of our industry. When I've got a couple of old car magazines here, because we've been looking at them, we'll discuss them later on, but I've got an issue of Car here, which is from January 1988, and it's got some of Steve's words in it, and he's, you know, one of the great motoring journalists of our generation.
Well, if you're a nerd like we are, and you're of a certain age, I think we all get a bit wistful and nostalgic about Car magazine from the 80s particularly. And it's his era in charge, which was, I don't know, sort of 83, 84,
mid to late 70s to
late 80s, Gavin Green took over, didn't he? But it's Cropley's stuff is... That was peak Car magazine.
Yeah, and they define what it was. But like, and I had a weekly column in Autocar. And the one thing you can't avoid, frankly, is repeating yourself. It has 51 issues a year of Autocar, the double special at Christmas. Mm. And you have to repeat yourself. And sadly, if you've got a weekly diary-based column, sometimes you get to the point where people can tell what's going to come. And I think Steve, for a while, slipped into that. And of course... You hit the zeitgeist because we were all. You said what we were thinking, which is what satirists do. So you did that one, and then I remember just a flow of other material that had me in hysterics. I remember when Steve Sutcliffe had again. These are all people I know and like. They'd put Steve on the cover of the magazine in a fairly ridiculous race suit to judge between what was best. A Ford Mondeo ST, or a Vectra GSI or something. And it was one of these grand statements that, looking back, was just not supportable. And it said, Vectra versus Mondeo, Sutcliffe decides. First of all, you think, no one gives a shit anyway about whether a Vectra is better than a Mondeo. Not even the people that work at Autocar. And we were really sad and still are. So he took the piss, and rather than having... Did you do Sharon versus Arafat, or was it Israel versus Palestine?
Yeah, it was. So I photoshopped it. So it was the original picture of Sutcliffe, but took the cars out and put in Arafat and I guess it was Ariel Sharon or Netanyahu, whoever was around at that point. And it was, yeah, Israel v. Palestine, Sutcliffe decide. But the reason that sort of, I suppose, works as a bit of satire is just because there's the sheer pomposity of the original. Because it's putting this magnitude on it that simply it does not deserve. It is only two
but you do know
rather
that,
similar
you, but you do know that, that, and I felt so sorry for Steve at that point, because, you know, I can remember him having to put on this bloody race suit and have this photo taken, and it's just the whole...
Well, now, hang on a minute. Were you not rummaging in the dressing up box more recently on the front of Top Gear magazine?
Oh, I've got
There
some.
Was one where you were dressed as Del Boy.
I've got Del Boy, Lederhosen. They put me in Lederhosen. Put me in Lederhosen. Because I was in a...
Do you get to keep those?
No, they're worth about £5,000 and they get handed down through generations.
Ones, were they?
They're proper
well,
ones.
You're going to need those
but also,
for Oktoberfest.
I profoundly offended the woman that gave them to me, because she turned around and said, but you're in a Porsche, that's from Stuttgart. It's just the wrong place. These are Bavarian, aren't they? These Lederhosen. So I was totally fraudulent. It's a bit like, I don't know, wearing something that's supposed to be from Newcastle and then turning up in Liverpool with it. It was just the worst thing I could
or
possibly have done.
Or even Sunderland.
Yeah.
Do you know, there's a story about that. Sorry, just as a little aside, but I love this story, that when the current Nissan Qashqai, which I don't believe Steve Sutcliffe has decided about, but it's a car people buy, when they ran the first... sort of pre-production or pilot build cars down the line in their factory in the northeast, they then camoed them up in black and white wrap. But the problem is that's the colours of Newcastle United. And some of the factory workers support Newcastle United, but then some of them support Sunderland, who are red and white. So in the end, as a political get out of jail...
Did they red and white some?
They did some of them in camo wrap that was red and white, so they didn't have a strike on their hands. So I thought it was quite sweet. That's quite a good thing. But can you imagine just going, black and white? All these Sunderland fans getting really radgy about it.
Can you imagine your football mentality being so partisan that you take offence at camo?
Yes, yeah. That you torch your own company's pre-production cars in fury.
Yeah, so I think we used to read it and just there was this great sense. It's a bit like Private Eye for a politician, I'm sure, this great sense that I don't want to be the next victim, but I'll be really proud when I am.
Yeah,
I think that was what was coming. You did get me quietly once, and I can admit to this now. I'm sure you knew what was going on, because I'm sure your sources were good. People were feeding you information all over the place.
Yeah,
I went to a wedding. In fact, I went to Richard Tuttle's wedding, and I might have had a whoopsie in a press car on the way there. Quite a large whoopsie. And you wrote another spoof news story about Autocar magazine, and at the bottom you just asterisked it, and you just said in italics, you wrote, unless your road test editor fails to make it to the handling day because you wrote off the Maserati or something. Yeah, you did. It was right at the bottom.
What
there.
A so, sneaky bugger I
so
was.
So someone, and I remember reading it and thought I got away with that, because I did. I did spank a Maserati on the way to...
It was a Maserati, wasn't it?
It was a Maserati. Sorry about that, Maserati.
How did you get to the wedding?
I turned up
on
late
a horse
to the
of shame.
I turned up in a taxi. This is before Uber, and the wedding was in rural Dorset. The Maserati was no longer serviceable. So
what was it? A 3200?
It was a 4200 GT, past tense. And I had to go to the wedding, and Tuts's mummy, who's a lovely woman, knows how useless I am anyway. I was in charge of car parking. as an usher at the wedding, so I turned up as everyone walked into the church. It was a proper fuck, 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 four weddings and a funeral moment. It was just ridiculous. A beautiful wedding, and I turned up late, and everyone knew I'd crashed the car. So I turned up late. The motoring journalist just had a crash in the car. I hastened to add it wasn't bad, and I don't think I was entirely to blame. And anyhow, I sat at the back. Having not discharged any of my duties, being glared at by the family for being useless, they knew I was going to be useless. And I got the feeling as I was being useless that there'd been a discussion that had preempted this somewhere in their house. Don't let him do anything because he's crap at life. And I just basically confirmed all of their suspicions. Anyway, I sat at the back next to this guy called Toby, who I've seen a few times since. He's a nice guy. And we're both in penguin suits. And he leans over to me during the service, because I was shuffling at the back, and he says, are you the guy that crashed the car? And I said, yes, I am. I kept my head down. He said, don't worry, some of us are worse off. And I went, why? He said, I forgot the trousers to my morning suit, so I have had to wear my wife's jeans. And he went, and I looked down, and the last turkey in the shop was sort of wedged up against the side of his jeans.
Do journalists always blame something else for a whoopsie?
They're like racing drivers.
Because I did read, I was listening to something with yourself, Richard, and I think your early days, I think you borrowed an Audi TT press car and wrapped it around a roundabout. And then they did some chassis changes, and that was Audi's fault.
I was vindicated. They did two things, actually, that vindicated me on that one. First of all, Audi recalled the car because it had dangerous handling, and I like to think
that was in the Vanguard discovery. Made all the difference.
Yeah, and also the roundabout, a very big roundabout underneath the motorway junction, and the car, what unsettled the car was there's a sort of fissure in the road where, you know, the gap between when the tarmac lane machine goes round. And they resurfaced it shortly afterwards as well.
They did. So it was the car and the roundabout.
And the road. It was, yeah. And I was, so I felt
you're vindicated. You're not even joking, are you? You genuinely believe this?
No, because the truth is, do you know what as well? I made the biggest mistake when I rolled. It flipped around twice, and then it hit the curb of the roundabout and it flipped over twice. And
Sorry, you rolled a TT?
Yeah, twice.
Christ alive, were you all right?
No, he was. No, it's fine. I was fine.
You were okay yourself.
Yeah, So what happened was
he was highly protected by the baseball
glove. Why
didn't
I know this?
Trim.
All this time when you're taking the piss out of me for being Troy Queef, and I didn't know that you'd rolled a TT. I'm looking for ammunition.
So it was, when would that have been? 98, 99, whenever the TT came out. And you remember when that car came out, it was quite sensational. You know, it's easy now. They're TTs, they're everywhere.
It was stunning.
It was a concept car that suddenly you could buy. Yeah. And that was amazing. So one was delivered. One of the first ones in the UK was delivered to the old Top Gear office, which is where I was working, my first job, my first proper job in telly. And it was for our producer, our series producer, Chris, who's still a mate of mine to this day, amazingly. But he was out on a shoot And this TT turned up, and I remember we all went out to the car park to look at it, which didn't normally happen with press cars, you know, unless it was something particularly amazing, and this was particularly amazing. We went out to the car park, we all pored over it. That was it. End of the day, Chris hadn't come back.
Please tell me there was someone a bit spotty grumbling going, it's just a golf underneath. Please tell me.
It was probably me, though, wasn't it? Spotty pedant. Sounds like, check. At the end of the day, Chris still wasn't back, and I thought, aye. So I rang him and I went, are you coming back into the office? No, I'm still on the shoot. We're not going to wrap up till over ages. Yeah. I was like, can I take that TT home for the night? And he went, yeah, all right, but bring it back tomorrow morning because I'm going away for the weekend. And he was taking his then girlfriend away for a sort of romantic weekend in this swanky new car to the countryside. And he was quite emphatic that I had to bring it back in one piece. And what I actually did was I got home and one of my housemates at the time, Hemel, was quite into his cars. And he went, can we go out in it? I went, yeah, no worries, let's do it. And we went ragging off. And I made the biggest mistake you can possibly make. Just as we came onto this roundabout at some lick, I went, of course, it's four-wheel drive, you see, so it's got loads of grip. And then I lost control and crashed it.
Christ, I didn't know that.
So yeah, we rolled over twice. Hemel headbutted me in the face as we rolled as well. So I ended up, my only injury was two black eyes. But then this guy in a Rover 200, it's amazing things you remember. A guy in a Rover 200 pulled over and went, oh my God, he'd seen it happen. He went, are you okay? And I went, I think so. And I saw my career flashing before my eyes.
I've had that quite a few times.
Yeah. it's a weird feeling, isn't it?
That's a serious, separate series of podcasts. Cars that Edwards crashed.
But then this guy went, because Hemel had gashed all his arm open on a bit of the interior trim. And he was bleeding quite a lot. And it looked worse than it was. And this guy went, I'm going to call an ambulance. We went, no, we'll be okay. And he went, no, I'm calling an ambulance. Ambulance turned up like that. And then they took me into the back of the ambulance. They went, are you okay? I said, yeah, I just banged my head. You think I got headbutted? And they went, how's your vision? And I went, it's blurry. It's blurry. My vision's blurry. My glasses have come off. And then they said, well, that's fine. We're going to take you to hospital. I had to go, no, I need to get my glasses, which I presume were in the wreckage somewhere. And they went, no, there's no time. You must come to hospital. And they scanned my head. But the worst thing is, I went into one of those tunnel things, they scanned my head, then they just left me lying there on this thing next to this big buzzing machine in the room on my own.
Blurry vision.
Yeah, which felt like for about half an hour. And I thought, I know what's happening here. They're working out how to come back in and break it to me. I've got like massive brain damage or something, or there's a big blood clot on my brain. And then they just came back in and went, no, you're fine.
Here are your glasses.
And then I thought, I had to go and get my glasses the next day from the garage that had recovered the wreckage. I rocked up with the guy who was in the car with me and went, hello, I did that to that car over there. And it was, I hadn't really, in the cold light of day as well, how absolutely spanned it was. It was really crumpled.
So it wasn't coming back?
No.
No.
The best thing that happened in terms
of...
No, it was a righty. It was right. One of the first righty ones, I guess. And
When you call the manufacturer the next day to say, put a car in the ditch at the weekend, how does that normally play out?
It's a phone call I never like making.
You normally make it though, do you? You don't pass it on to the assistant.
You don't. Yeah, you have to make the phone call yourself as the adult normally. I've not had to make many.
When I did the Audi one, I remember this. I can't remember who it was, but it was a lady who was in charge of PR, I guess, at that point. And I can't remember her name, but I called
her. Was it Janet
her.
Mills then?
No, it wasn't. I rang whoever was sort of the ranking officer at that point at Audi Press. And I said, we've got a TT off you at the moment. I'm afraid I've had a bit of an accident in it. And she went, oh my goodness, are you okay? And I thought, this is a good sign.
This is a good sign.
And I went, yeah, I'm fine, but the car is...
Because I've had the same with someone I know was driving an Audi. It had a massive stack with a couple of kids in it.
Oh.
And the first question wasn't, how are they? It was, how's the car?
Oh.
And that was the other way around. I just thought, don't like that. Think whatever happens, it's just a bit of metal, isn't it, really? Yeah. You've got to make sure the occupants are all right.
Yeah.
And then you can start worrying about the car afterwards.
Yeah.
The
when I binned the TT, Audi were really good about it, it was obviously a huge relief. My producer, on the other hand, was extremely cross about it.
Who was the producer?
Our series producer, a guy called Chris Richards, who now...
You mentioned it.
He is he's now one of the brilliant people behind Travelman.
Okay.
And he's still a friend of mine. You'd like him. He used to race an old Formula Ford. Got an Elise now as his fun car. He's one of us. But he was quite cross at the time with me.
You just have to... it just causes grief, doesn't it? Because the yin and the yang of our industry is that I've always felt you earn the right to be a bit cheeky. You earn the right to be rude. If the product's there to have the Mickey taken out of it, you can do that. If you barrel roll something, however hardened and independent you are, it probably makes it more difficult to be rude about their next car. Yeah. I'm not saying I've done that actively, but I think subliminally, it's difficult not to get yourself in that position.
It's just basic human decency because it feels rude. And a great example for me was I borrowed, when Infiniti launched themselves here, and I borrowed one of their cars, the sort of 3 Series size one. And it was a shitty car.
You can't even remember what it was called.
No, I can't. I honestly can't.
Their cars.
Just pick a number and a couple of letters all by the way around. It was one of those. It was just not a good car. But I held back from giving it a good kicking because when it was delivered, they pushed the keys through my letterbox and my dog ate them. And that is an embarrassing conversation to have. Thing is, it was keyless. So what happened was my wife rang me. I was in the Top Gear office and my wife rang me. She went, that car you said was being delivered, it's turned up. I was like, all right, great. Yeah, the keys come through the letterbox. She went, yeah, the dog's eaten them. And I was like, no, come on, seriously. And she went, no, the dog has eaten the keys. And my first thought was the dog.
Hold on a second, so it's keyless. The car was keyless.
It's keyless, and I thought they've gone into the dog. I can just hold the dog in the car.
As long as
the dog comes with me everywhere, this is fine. But no, what she'd actually done was chewed up the key fob and spat it out. So it's circuit boards and bits and pieces.
It's easier to digest that way.
Brilliant.
Well, it seemed like most of it hadn't got into the dog, including the battery, because that would have probably been quite bad. But then I did sort of try and reassemble it and hold it near the car. No dice. But then, you know, those modern keyless things, they have the physical key hidden inside. So I took that. I was able to open the lock on the outside. But then there's no ignition inside. And then the car flipped out because it thought it was being stolen. And the alarm went off. And there's no way to turn it off again. It was a nightmare. And I had to ring Infiniti and go, I know this is going to sound ridiculous, but my dog's eating your key. And and it was just before Christmas as well, I think. So they were all closing down to go away, and they had to try and get the spare to me, which they did. I then drove the car. Oh, I shouldn't admit this, but screw it. They're going out of business, aren't they? They're leaving the UK. So I away with the knowledge that this car is now somewhere in the dealer network, or because I can't imagine it's been sold, even though this was 4 or 5 years ago. But so that was the first thing that happened. Then I managed to dent the inside of the door shut just slightly, moving a heavy object out of the back seat that I hadn't. It was a long story, but basically I screwed up there, and I was like, oh no. And then on Christmas Day, went up to see my brother and his wife, and as we left, I was driving, so I was stone cold sober. Just wanted to get home so maybe I could have a beer on Christmas evening. And my sister-in-law gave us a bag of leftover things, including, for some reason, half a tub of cream that we'd had for Christmas pud, I guess, which leaked and went through and leaked on the back seat. So that when we got home, and I just wanted to get inside, there's a well in the seat that's just full of cream.
Brandy cream.
And as we know, you know, dairy products leaked in a car, that's just terrible. So then, of course, I've got to spend half an hour sort of trying to drown it out with water and mop it up. And all the time I'm wearing a jocular Christmas jumper, but feeling very unjocular. And then I wrote about that car and I kind of went, well, you know, I mean, they're new. It's a long way to go, isn't it? Because I was thinking, I want to go. It's absolute dog shit. It's got terrible steering. But unfortunately, I've both destroyed the keys and made it stink
of
milk.
So I'd better be a bit less horrible about it. No. And had you done something wrong that Christmas for that to be your Christmas car? Because I hate to say it, in the old days, editorial office, if you wanted to see the real hierarchy of the office, Christmas cars, who got what?
Yes.
And if you got an Infiniti, whatever it was called, you must have done something. Had you pissed in Jeremy's tea or something?
No, because we didn't run that kind of thing at Top Gear on the telly show. There was no... I, as a freelance journalist, I used to sometimes borrow cars for Christmas, but I would just sort... I think it was just, you know, I was running through the list of cars that I thought I should borrow because I used to be a bit more diligent and try and drive
same,
new
yeah,
stuff.
Yeah, I really miss that. You could walk into the office and just say, I haven't driven a Toyota Aris. I don't want to, but I haven't driven one, and therefore it's a hole in my knowledge. I want to drive one again. Whereas now, there's no reason why I'd ever book one in.
I just remembered something, and actually, this relates to something you've been trying to do, but on the Top Gear TV show years ago, way early days, so 2003, 2004, Andy Wilman, our exec producer, and a guy called Gary Hunter, who was the he was the exec, and Gary was the, and Andy was the series producer, and I was the script editor, and we were sort of so kind of three of the sort of more senior people in the office were allowed to book press cars, and we used to book in cars all the time, and we decided, the three of us, what we should do is look at categories of cars. So say Astra sized cars, and it's like, okay, Gary, you book in an Astra, I'll book in a Focus, Andy book in a Golf, and then we'll go around and we'll do i30 and we'll do whatever Nissan's making and so on. And you know, so we'll try and get all of the main players in one segment of car that one of us will have driven them. We'll compare notes, we'll make it a feature on the show, where we'll just do one of those kind of, right, okay, you're thinking of buying one of these size cars. Here's what we think.
Richard, you've not been listening in some of our script meetings, have you, by any chance?
Really? Well, anyway, what happened is we kind of just lost the will to live doing it. I stayed on. I remember once going to all the way to like Cadwell Park in an Avensis because we were doing medium-sized salutes. And just going, what am I doing? Why am I doing this? But I stuck at it. Gary, who just liked booking in really flash stuff because he wasn't a car guy, he's just a BBC bloke, had gone, what, I can have nice cars now because I do Top Gear. He just basically gave up. I think I saw him once and he turned up at a shoot and he was in an S-Class coupe. And I was like, aren't we supposed to be doing Super Minis this week? He was like, oh, I couldn't be bothered. So with that idea just went west because, yeah, the other two just went, oh, can't be arsed with this.
I always thought that that one of the clever strategies that you guys devised back in the day with Top Gear was that, you know, you accepted the fact that ordinary cars are just boring, so that they needed an idea around them. And so, yeah, really, if you're going to review the Ignis, you've got to play football with it. You know, you need to find a stunt,
yeah,
because people will not tolerate 7 minutes on a Vauxhall Astra. They just won't.
We had a great moment once where there was a guy called Joe Jacuzzi. Fantastic name, and genuinely is part of the Jacuzzi dynasty, who invented, you know, the Jacuzzi. And he was the head of communications at Vauxhall for a while, an American guy, and he did comms here. Came in with his deputy, a guy called Dennis Chick, who, yeah, you remember, who's retired now. And Dennis ran through, as car companies used to come in and see us, as I guess they did at Autocar, would sort of go, we just wanted to come and see you and tell you what we've got coming up, yeah, so that you're aware, if you're planning for the future, what you might want to book in, which, you know, with someone like Vauxhall was a bit, we had to sort of smile politely and go, yeah, that all sounds great. And Dennis did the big presentation. Okay, this is big news for us this year, and the biggest news, of course, is the new Insignia. It's going to be really big for us. This is going to be, you know, it's new car and all this, and went through this whole spiel. And we sat there and listened politely. And at the end of it, Joe Jacuzzi, the man who's just done the presentation's boss, just goes, let me tell you something. I don't want to see an Insignia on Top Gear. That would bore the ass off me. And you could see Dennis Chick just sitting there going, oh, what have I just wasted my time doing? And this guy, he was a massive fan of the show. And he went, listen, I watch the show with my kids. I don't want to see an Insignia on the show. I want to see shit blowing up. Not like And he basically just told us not to book his company's flagship new product that was coming out. And I thought, well, this guy's fantastic.
You just the go back to the press car delivery. Reminded me of my favourite ever press car delivery, which was to the house I lived in Wales. So I do you remember back in the day with the big Daimler Chrysler merger?
Yeah,
they started selling Dodge Rams in the UK, so you could buy a Dodge Ram, yeah, 1500 as a UK warranted vehicle. It was a lefty. They weren't converted.
God, I don't remember that.
And they had one on the press fleet.
Right.
And I thought, well, I'll get this thing in because I've got to do a bit of wooding over the weekend. I'll have it in the field and mess around with it, do what I do. So I booked it in, and it was supposed to arrive whatever time. And it arrived about half an hour late, which is fine. Doesn't matter. Guy knocks on the door and he's flustered. This guy is flustered. And he goes, I've got the vehicle outside. And he said, can I just leave you the keys? I thought, oh, I'd just like to come and have a quick look at it. So we walked out and he was just mortified as we walked towards it. And the right-hand side wing mirror was just obliterated. There was a stump left. It's left-hand drive. So clearly he's been driving along in the middle of the road and he's just hit something. And he just says to me, look, I'm afraid I was driving down. There's a bus being driven in a very antisocial manner. He's all over the road, and he's just hit me. And I can't take responsibility for it. And I thought, well, I can't, because I've never driven the vehicle, so I can't be responsible for the wing mirror that you've clearly taken off because you've not driven a left-hand drive car before. Anyhow, he says, so if I was to give you the keys, that's fine, isn't it? I went, no, it's really not. And actually, looking at it, you've dented the door as well. So I think you better just take it back, because I don't really want that. And he said, well, no, I really need to leave it. And he was about to just walk off down the lane. And I said, well, can you at least just park it up? And he went, you could tell, that was where I was being a bit cruel. You could tell he never, ever wanted to see this fucking vehicle ever again. And so he got in it, and he was so, by this stage, I think he'd lost it completely. And there's a barn opposite me that doesn't belong to me. And he got in it, stuck it in reverse, and fired it at considerable speed straight into the side of the barn. And took out the bumper, the tailgate, and the left rear wing. So now two corners of the vehicle are properly in trouble. And and then he just basically just sat there with his head in his hands, just broken. And I didn't know what to say. I'm really sorry, and I want to help you here.
Do you want to come and help me with some wooding?
No, I just said, but you really have to go now. You have to take your Dodge and leave. And I never drove it. They just took it back.
Do you know, I discovered, though, for modern cars, the door mirrors come off quite easily. I think for pedestrian safety reasons.
Yeah, they do, yeah.
Because we had, do you remember that Megane, the sort of the big bum Megane?
Yeah, yeah.
We were going to do a big thing on that on Top Gear, and they sent us a pre-production one, right-hand drive, but it was pre-prod, and just so we could have a go in it, I think, and look at it and decide what we're going to do. And I took it home, dark night, street where I used to live was very narrow. You can hear the excuses building up here. Skip sticking out, and I was busy looking for parking space, looking the other way, and just dunk. Clipped the skip at not very high speed at all, like sort of 5 miles an hour or something. And the door mirror just on the passenger side just went boom and came off. So I stopped and picked it up and threw it in the boot. And then, but I had to ring. There was a guy who was the PR guy at Renault at that point who was very, very dry indeed. And so I rang him and went, and bear in mind, this is like the first right-hand drive Megane in the country. So they kind of wanted it back in one piece. And I had to ring him and go, I'm really sorry, I've knocked the door mirror off. I'm so sorry. It was an accident. I didn't mean to do it. And he went, and where is the mirror? And I went, it's in the boot. And he went, it's not doing much good there, is it?
Oh!
And yeah, there was no sympathy at all. Which is, I know, it was a stupid mistake. I can't think of any. I don't think I've ever damaged another press car. That's it. I wrote off an Audi and I knocked the door mirror off a Renault Megane. And that's, I think, it. Touch wood.
And now, with no sense of irony, I'm going to say, on that bombshell, we are going to end the first half of the podcast. Go and have a cup of tea and maybe a little comfort break, maybe a slice of cake, and we'll see you afterwards. Cheers.
Collecting Cars, the safe, smart and simple way to buy and sell collectible cars. An online auction platform for the UK and Europe. Follow us on Instagram at Collecting Cars and also collectingcars.com.
The CollectingCars.com podcast with Chris Harris and Edward Lovett.
Welcome back to part two of this Collecting Cars podcast with Edward Lovett. That's at Edward Lovett. And Richard Porter, who is at Sniff Petrol. And I love the fact that he's at Sniff _ Petrol on Instagram, because that means no one's ever going to find him. I'm just looking at the January 1988 edition of Car Magazine that I bought in, and a group test which just says, Gentleman Racers. MG Montego Turbo versus Alpha 75 Twin Spark versus Citroen BX19 GTI 16 valve. I mean, these are the cars of our dreams, right?
I would have all three, probably at the same time. So one of them was working.
Okay, say you had all three in your garage ready to go.
Yeah.
What occasions would you reserve for each vehicle? So for the Montego, how would you deploy the Montego?
I feel like the Montego would be my go-to everyday one.
Okay, interesting. So what would be the one that you'd take the lady to the country retreat in?
There's not a lady alive that would want to. My wife would just be like, what have you done?
Can you imagine?
Where is the nice car you used to have?
We're going to Babington House.
I think you could get away with the Alpha to Babington. That is the one I'd probably take. The BX...
You'd just have to park it on the street and walk down the drive.
But the Alpha has got that, because it's an Alpha. I mean, it's not the prettiest Alpha, but because it's an Alpha, I think you could get away with that kind
not
of...
Not the prettiest
Alpha. All right. Fairly far down the list of pretty Alphas. But it does have that kind of... Oh, well, look, he's got an Italian car. I bet he likes opera as well. What a cultured man he is. Whereas the BX... So, oh... a French farm worker has turned up for some reason here. I once got almost smoked in France by a Citroën BX, not a GTI, but just a normal BX, winding country road. And as I sort of came onto infrequent straights in a Clio hire car that I was properly thrapping, could see this BX, and it was getting closer and closer and closer. And then finally, I turned into the place where we were staying, and as I did, by this point, the BX was right at my arse, and as I turned in, I noticed as it went by, it had a little trailer on the back as well, and it was being driven by this 112-year-old man who had, like, one of those brilliant French farmer faces, like a sort of deflated basketball, and a little black cap on as well.
Yeah, they do. Like, they all look like Yoda, and they drive like Alan Plos, don't they?
Incredible, yeah. I think he probably had a tab on as well, because, well, he would, wouldn't he?
But a BX on a really bumpy French D road is unbeatable. I'm just looking at, I'll put this down in a minute, because there's nothing like reading a magazine on a podcast, because you guys can't see it, can you? But the Alpha 75's interior was always a piece of wonder to me, because as a kid I'd read the magazine, because I didn't know anyone that had an Alpha 75, because most of my parents' friends were sane. And the handbrake had that sort of, it was a complete bar, wasn't it?
It was a
U-shape that went round the glove box. Mm. And the electric window switches were in the roof.
Yes. Because that makes sense.
What were they thinking? Anyhow, now, on to far more important matters. Now,
what, more important than the MG Montego and the Citroën?
I'll rephrase that. On to newer car matters, because nothing's more important than the Montego did 127 miles an hour, I just noticed, and 0 to 123 and a half seconds.
Have you ever driven a Montego?
Yes. I've driven a the one I liked, and I can admit this in public, was they did the Countryman Estate with the diesel engine was a really good car. They were cracking. Now I drove a Montego Turbo,
yeah,
and it was shit.
We did a thing. Sorry, I keep banging on about Top Gear, like some kind of terrible old fart.
Were you a part of Top Gear?
I did work on Top Gear, funny enough. I've only just mentioned it once or twice. But we did a thing years ago where the presenters built their own ambulances, and we went down to this old army base down in Kent to do this big sequence, because it had like rows of houses, a training range, so houses and buildings and stuff like that. And we could just muck around as much as we wanted, but we wanted to dress some of the streets with cars. So someone just went to a scrappy, basically, and bought about 10, 15 cars. And they all came off the transporter, and most of them were dead.
No.
And they looked quite new, like sort of Peugeots and Renaults and things like that. And they'd been killed by ECU Fritzes and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So they were great for dressing the street.
Or scrappage. Maybe it was scrappage as well. Was it that sort of time?
No, I think it was probably pre-scrappage. But our producer went down to set all this up, discovered with delight that one of the cars that came off the transporter started and ran well. And it was a Montego Countryman, 2-litre petrol.
Oh, come on.
And it became our site hack. No, that 2-litre O series has a lusty engine. It pulled. And the gear change had a beautiful gear change on it. And we used it as our site hack.
Richard.
And I started fighting
Richard,
other people for the keys.
Stop. Let your trousers calm down. There was nothing beautiful about that gear change.
I was driving Clarkson around it, and he just, without me saying anything, he went, "You really like this car, don't you?" In a sort of slightly despairing way. And then James and I got in, and James was so excited about it that we ended up, because we found out it was still taxed, I think, or we'd put tax. No, I can't remember. We went out of the base to go to the Naffy to buy James some cigarettes. And James drove it. I was going, "James, isn't the gear change lovely?" And he went, "Oh, yes, it's got quite good steering." And I was thinking, we are strange men. But it was a lovely car. We liked it so much, and so many people on our team, it grew weirdly attached to this scruffy.
Did it get brought back to Dunsfold?
We wanted to bring it back to Dunsfold to have it as the site hack there, and unfortunately, someone forgot to say to the guy, the scrappy coming back to get them, don't take the Montego.
Did it get crushed?
It got crushed, yeah.
For those that have subscribed to the Collecting Cars podcast because of meeting the man that sold McLaren F1s new, I'm sorry we've had to drag on someone who drove Renault Montegos new. We will reinstate some sort of norm.
I told you that ours is a broad church. Now, recently, if you've either follow myself or Richard on Twitter, he's at SniffPetrol, you might have noticed that we disagreed about a new vehicle that I drove last week. He was obviously wrong, but I'm going to give him his chance to try and support his weird argument now. There's a new Toyota Supra that's just been launched, and I drove it last week, and I thought it was one of the most confusing cars I've ever driven, because I've never driven something that was supposed to feel so deliberately Japanese and have a car feel so German. And I for me, cars have to have a personality, particularly cars that are halo figures and are there ostensibly to kind of promote a brand's DNA around the globe. And if you're going to do that, I think it kind of needs to reflect what you want your car company to be. And if that is just rebodying someone else's work, I'm not sure that's a great idea. Anyhow, Richard's standpoint, which he will now tell you about, is rather different.
Well, so this started because you said on Twitter, I forget your exact opening gambit to this. Oh, I think you were addressing all other car journalists.
This started because you said.
Yeah. Mum, Chris is doing that thing again. You said to all of the car journalists, I can't remember how you expressed it, but basically you were saying, just remember it's a BMW underneath, or something like that, weren't you?
No, I did the other way around. Okay. I said, just go and drive it, and don't listen to what they say to you. That's what I said. Because there was a lot of Jedi mind tricks going on. They rolled out the engineer to give you the full story about how they, you know, from 2012, they've been developing this car together, and that really, there's a bit of Jack and Ori in there.
I'm sure there is, but my contention was, and this was off the bat, because I was already a bit narky about all this, because I'd read some of the reviews that morning before I'd seen you on Twitter, and I'd seen at least two reports on it that they were written by car journalists, it felt for car journalists, because they were going... The worst thing about the Supra is you'll notice immediately all the BMW switch gear. And I sort of thought, well, you will if you're a car journalist, because you've just had an M4 long-term and you probably drove to Heathrow in an X3 or something. You'll notice that because you're constantly driving BMWs. Someone who is chopping in, I don't know, let's say a Boxster or something, probably they'll be aware, because it is a car person's car, they'll be aware it's BMW switches.
But you don't think it's a problem?
I think if they could... they could do it properly, it would be great, because it. I know what you mean. See, the thing is, I do, conversely, I thought it was a mistake that Aston Martins of the last generation all had Volvo electric window switches and electric mirror controls and all that sort of stuff. Well, and
the mirror tog was actually quite pleasing.
Yeah, but the reason that was wrong, or at least it undermined the appeal of those cars for their target audiences, someone who's buying a DB9, I can guarantee... that a large percentage of those will also have an XC90 as their family car.
Yeah.
And they'll go, oh, it's got the same controls as our family bus. That's a bit disappointing. That's where bits sharing can come undone. The Supra, it's not about how the aircon controls work. It's about how it drives. And I do believe Toyota's Jack and Ori about they tuned it. I mean, I haven't driven it, obviously. I haven't driven the Z4 as well.
I can't think of a car that feels more BMW in the way that it sounds or drives.
But is that a problem?
I think if you're dealing with an Auris or you're dealing with a Celica, it's not a problem at all. I totally understand, you know, the modern economic prerogative of the car industry that you've got to share bits. And also that so much is homogenised anyway. Realistically now, when you start designing a new car, you go to the same... you all go to Bosch, you all go to Michelin.
Yeah.
You get the same black boxes. You know, you're increasingly dealing with a homogenised product. But I think that if you're dealing with your halo sports car, you know, the thing that's supposed to be perhaps your last ever internal combustion engine sports car, I thought you might do a bit more with it rather than just... rebody a BMW, and it really is. I just, when you look inside it, you think you couldn't even be asked to change that bit. Now, of course, I've been a bit impish in the story I've written because I want to poke some fun at it. And the reality is, of course, the infrastructure of a modern car comes as a package, doesn't it? Once you've bought the dashboard, you can't play with anything because it'll make some sensor go off, and that means it will be inoperable. So you've got to have iDrive or Monkey Drive, whatever you used to call it on Sniff Petrol.
I can't remember.
Do you remember Monkey Drive?
Monkeytronic.
Monkeytronic, that was it.
Monkey came out of the glove box. So and I think the buttons for you.
I get all that. And to come back to your point about switchgear, I had this brought home to me brilliantly by, do you remember Harry Carlton, who was the guy that used to do PR for Aston Martin? He was Ford's man, and then he did his dotage at Aston Martin. He turned up, the first test car I ever had from them was a DB9. And I was young and stupid. I'm now old and stupid, but I was pretty stupid then. And he turned up and he obviously took a fairly dim view of the strategically shaved chimp that had come to collect the car from him. He just thought, well, good God, what's happened to the industry? They let people like him in the door. And he handed over the car, and I said, and in those days you got given the Ford key.
Yeah.
And it didn't even have the plipper on it. It was just it was the spare key. Yeah, remember, it wasn't even the night key.
Yeah.
And I looked at it and went, ugh. And then I sort of turned it on, and you immediately had a load of Mondeo switchgear straight next to you.
And that wasn't DB9, though. That was DB7, wasn't it? That was
sorry, sort of you're right, DB7. Sorry, it was a DB7. And I turned it on, and I made some comment about the Ford switchgear. And he leant in and said, "What you're forgetting is most of our customers have never sat in a Ford."
Yeah.
And he wasn't wrong.
No.
So your point about the XC90 and a modern Aston Martin stands. I suppose the other thing about the Supra that I find very disappointing, that as a statement of health, as a statement of the broader health of the industry that we all love, because we do agree on that, we love cars.
Mm.
When a $1 trillion organisation, the second largest car company in the world, can't make its own sports car and has to roll out a rebodied BMW with a really nice story with it, I just think it's a bit sad, and I just
yeah,
I think
but
they
they're
could
a
do
trillion
better.
Dollar company for a reason.
Yeah,
they don't write a lot of checks if they don't have to.
And I also think the cars that it's competing against.
Maybach, your premier destination for luxury resale. Elevate your style with our curated collection of bags, watches, and fine jewelry. At Rebag, quality is our priority. Each piece meticulously vetted and verified by experts, ensuring your investment is nothing short of perfection. Buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Hermes, Chanel, and Cartier. Access expertly crafted and hard-to-find pieces that redefine luxury. Your next investment awaits at Rebag. Get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. That's 10% off the luxury you deserve. Don't miss out. Head to Rebag.com and enter code REBAG10 at checkout. That's REBAG10.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Weirdly, and I think in difficultly, if that's even a word, for Toyota, are dripping with character. You know, the Alpine is a brilliant piece of reinvention. The little Alpine A110.
Yeah, it's a cracking car. Although I wrote a column about this in Evo because I had booked one in, forgetting it was due to come the week I was having a vasectomy, and it's a painful car to drive if you've just had your knackers snipped. And I wrote a whole column about this, and it's got the best reaction of any column I've written for years.
People loved it. It was a very good column.
But I just thought, oh God, I hope I don't die next week, because everyone will just remember, oh, he's the guy who wrote that column about having his balls
the epitaph
cut when then driving a sports car.
I used to hate writing. We were fellow columnists for how long? A couple of years.
Yeah, I guess so. In Evo, yeah.
That was one of the toughest gigs of my life. Being a columnist next to him, because he's on his game, this one. And I used to open the issue of the magazine and read his column and go, oh, bollocks, he's nailed it.
I probably did used to put more effort in those days, because I remember I was staying somewhere where there was a copy of Evo, had been left, an old copy, and I was thumbing through it, and it was one of my columns, and it was from when I first been given that column. And I read it and went, oh my God, I used to put effort in. This is like... This feels like I've sort of redone it a few times and made it proper, and it's like, God, just because you know that thing. Anyone who's ever had to work to anything where you're getting stuff in print, the deadline is always yesterday, and you suddenly go, oh no, I haven't done my column. And now a lot of magazines have gone to 13 issues a year. It feels like it is sort of every other day you're
weekly,
being asked for something. Yeah.
And
there's always that sense of panic. Now I'm basically sitting on my bottom, not doing anything at the moment. My Evo column should get a bit better again because I've got more time to do them.
No, so I'm going to drive a Supra again tomorrow.
Oh, are you?
I think it's good to drive.
Well, this is my question: is it good to drive? Is it good fun?
It's not what I call out and out fun. It's not fun in the way that the Alpine is, because the Alpine's trick is that it's a delight at low speed. You don't have to be going very fast at all for it to feel different to a normal car. That's what I love about
it. Yeah, I like that way that it goes over bumps at low speed, because you can sense how light it is. It doesn't sort of thud into bumps with a sheer mass. It just sort of skips.
And it's got lovely wheel travel, so you can feel it kind of, you know, to use that Lotus phrase, breathing with the road. It's lovely. And it doesn't do that, obviously. And it just feels, the DNA of the chassis feels very BMW. I mean, if you drive a lot of BMWs, you get used to the way a normal BMW feels and an M car feels. Now, to me, normally, a sort of a rear-engine BMW product that's supposed to be quite fast but doesn't have an M badge on it is a bit disappointingly squidgy at the rear. That there's basically a sense of the bushing being quite soft and they do squirm around and move a bit on the rear axle. And the M cars tend to go too far the other way, and they're a bit overbushed and a bit stiff on the road. And this Supra is right in the middle of that, and it does feel very DNA in its BMW DNA in its chassis language and the way that it steers and drives. That's not a bad thing.
No, sorry, just to check, because I know I've already lowered the tone with the Montego chat. But yeah. How nerdy do you go on this podcast?
Go right in, yeah.
Because I used to like, do you remember the BMW 3 Series Compact? The first one, the second one where they put a proper...
The 325 TI.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
I have one of those, very good.
And that had that squidge at the back end. And I remember driving one of those across of Northamptonshire. I was going to the Evo office, and on a beautiful sunny morning, and feeling it sort of sitting down out of bends. You know, you could really sort of then... kind of slow and fast outy sort of thing, but as you stamped on it to go out of the bend, it sort of squatted down a bit, and I quite liked that squidginess to it.
I don't like that, because for me what happens in those sorts of BMWs, and they've been BMWs particularly guilty of this over the years, that the initial response to your throttle input, so you smash the throttle, your brain wants something to happen at the back, and rather than feeling that the tire moves against the asphalt, you feel some rubber in the suspension compress or move, and then the tire does something. And I don't like that squishiness.
Oh, hey, that's another car that you and I don't agree about, was the current M3/4.
Oh, you think it's too much, don't you?
I just thought it was yeah. But also, what I don't like about, I gather they've made it better though.
They have. But I think the one I had a later one.
Right.
Because I drove a trade car, an earlier one, and it was bloody lively on the road. It was definitely spikier than the one I had.
We had one on Evo's Car of the Year in Scotland, well, a very early one. They've just come out. And it was so bizarrely
on a down road,
unpredictable.
Yeah.
We thought there was something wrong with it.
The current car.
Mm.
Doesn't that die?
What?
On the Evo Car of the Year, the M4.
No, I couldn't possibly say.
It did.
Yeah, I don't.
It did. It did.
I'd gone home by then.
Yeah, yeah.
So it definitely wasn't me. Yeah.
I'd gone home by then.
But that turbocharged engine.
What in
the M4.
Yeah.
You know, it's not easy to use for some people.
Savage torque delivery.
It has, yeah. You see these cars coming up, some videos coming out of Cars and Coffee and them sort of bolting off the road.
Lord, yeah.
If you see it, then everyone's like, that guy can't drive, but he's just not prepared for what's about to come with the torque delivery.
Certainly in an M3 and M4, I'd advise, unless you're really on top of your game, leave the button on, don't play. It's when they turn the button off.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, now there's something else that drives me slightly nuts. I wouldn't claim to be a hero driver, and I would generally leave stability controls and all of that sort of stuff on, or just to, you know, put it in the middle setting. I was same Car of the Year Evo test in the Scottish Borders. We had the 458 Speciale, which is probably still my favourite car, or one of my favourite cars. It's an absolutely fantastic thing. But the first time I drove it, Marino Franchitti was there, who I guess you know as well, don't you? And Marino, in his usual sort of...
I love the fact that you've called him Franchitti as well. He'll love that.
Why? Franchitti?
Franchitti, that's the one.
Slaphead.
Might be a different one.
Slaphead?
So,
Mino, you're going to love that, mate. Slaphead.
But in his usual sort of excitable Marino slapheady way, he pulled up where I was standing in the Ferrari, leapt out, didn't even switch it off, and he was just like, oh, it's brilliant, it's amazing, 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 amazing. What?
And he left it with it all off.
Yes. I didn't know that. He just went, you've got to drive it now. And I got in and went, okay, and I set off and I was like, whoa, and it was a little bit damp in some of the bits through the trees. And at one point it got a bit squirmy and then it sort of, I was like, whoa, God, blimey, it's real. And then I realised it was all off and I was like, oh my God, I could have died. Because, well, you know that car, it's actually a bit sort of sharp if everything's off.
Were you being a helmsman, Smith, right?
I was being a bit of a Tillerman. No, my most Tillerman-y thing was when I at the end of that day, I think, and it was beautiful evening, and you know, the Scottish Borders is a staggeringly beautiful part of the world, and we were going back to where we were staying, and I was following someone who had a, you know, one of the flinty-eyed helmsmen who was in the Ferrari, and I was in the F-Type R, the original rear-wheel drive one, which again,
they've got good
quite
traction.
A lively car,
Jesus
and
Christ.
I thought, I've got this. I'll stay up with the Ferrari. And I was trying to keep up with the Ferrari. And then just, there was a moment of clarity where I suddenly went, what are you doing? Stop it. Just calm down.
The F-Type R actually has a WD-40 dispenser that just drizzles oil onto the rear tyres. What's going on there?
I once had a really embarrassing moment in one of those. Some traffic lights on the North Circular Road in London where I pulled alongside a Boxster and I thought, time for you to go to school, my friend. Lights went green. I stamped on it and it just stopped. Well, it just briefly lit up, and then of course the computer went and just shut everything down, and the Boxster just calmly drove away at normal speed.
They certainly lack some traction now. To continue a part of that subject, I've always wanted to ask you this, and I probably never have done when we're sober, so we'll try and get it recorded now. You made your name satirising the motor industry and did it brilliantly, and that got you a job on Top Gear, rightly so. And you know, the rest is kind of history. But where do you stand on?
God, don't say immigration. Or
no,
sorry.
Yeah, where do you stand on Palestine? No. Because you take the mickey out of people that take driving a bit too seriously and the process of driving and fast cars. You've always sort of popped that balloon, and yet you've been a columnist on Evo for 18 years, which is sort of, that's the Bible of that vernacular. It's the Bible of that code. So yep. So are you poacher or gamekeeper, or are you just sort of in the soup somewhere making noise?
I'm just an ingrate, I suppose. I don't know. No one has actually asked me that before, and it's a good point. The thing is, after I'd started doing Sniff Petrol, I was taken to lunch by the editor of Autocar at the time. And I'd done a few things about Autocar, but he quite rightly went, I get that this comes from, I don't think he used these words, but this is to paraphrase, it comes from a position of love. You couldn't satirise and parody what we do unless you were an avid reader of the magazine. And he was right. And because when I started Sniff Petrol, it's because I'd been made unemployed. Or, you know, in our world, you go, oh, I'm freelance now. But I was basically unemployed. And for the first year, probably more like 2 years, before I got the job on Top Gear, I didn't have an awful lot of work on. And I used to love just buying Autocar on a Wednesday and then going to the pub, and I'd sit in the pub and have a couple of pints and read Autocar. It was just, I was like, that was my happy place. And so, but then probably go home and write something really bitchy about them. So and the same with Evo. I love Evo. And I think the thing about Evo is that
Evo contains almost wall-to-wall examples of the stuff that you take the piss out of.
I always thought Autocar was a little bit more po-faced about it.
Oh, no, and I agree, but Evo still contains that type of content.
Yes, yeah, yeah. I mean, there is, you know, when they're getting into the minutiae of sort of tread shuffle and things like that, you sort of go, oh, give over. Come on. Tread shuffle was always, we had all of these different sort of, Clarkson and May and Hammond and I always have a lot of these sort of things. Because we used to sit around, we used to record the studio things for Top Gear on a Wednesday. And we'd have the fresh copy of Autocar.
We still do, by the way, in the new Top Gear.
Did you stop doing that for a while, though? The Wednesday
we did,
routine.
It's
a good routine.
Because Mr. Tribbiani can only be here for certain days of the
year. You know, he's not called Tribbiani. I love the fact that you call Matt LeBlanc Joey. And it's like, it's an inability to distinguish between. Anyway, what was I saying? Oh, yes, there were various things, but we used to always, the way that we would sum up the sort of po-faced helmsman attitude to car journalism was always the phrase tread shuffle was the way that it was like a little shorthand. Just someone would be reading Autocar, you know, I'd just be reading it, and Jeremy would go, much talk of tread shuffle this week. And then we'd look through it for photos of the writers driving.
Oh, I used to love
for
those.
Two things: oversteer face,
oversteer face,
and also the I'm not enjoying this, which was sort of a spin-off of oversteer face, which, you know, someone looking very serious.
Yeah.
And we'd go, oh, look at this man. He's driving someone else's £200,000 car, yeah, and he's not enjoying it at all. But again, it's sort of, if we hated it and if we thought it was complete rubbish, we wouldn't even be looking at it. It's like Autocar is a part of, same as Car Magazine, you know, and you've got that old 80s Car Magazine there. And that was pre-internet, pre-computer games and stuff.
I used to go to the newsagent, Sky of Off Lessons, buy it, sit at the back of the class, and I would read it cover to cover 10 times before the next one came out.
I would go, this is like a weird confessional lab. I would go to the newsagent McColl's in Wilmslow, and if the new car magazine wasn't in when it's supposed to be, I would cycle home again, and then later I would probably ring the newsagent just on the off chance it had come in again. That's how much I was jonesing for car magazine.
Hello, do you have a copy of J.R. Hartley's Fly Fishing?
I used to get copies of Razzle and just tuck car magazine inside so no one knew I was reading it.
No, I do the same, and I have a great affection for Autocar because I wouldn't have a job unless I'd started there. But, you know, even when I was working there, I could see that we operated on the most absurd level. And I think one of the things I've always felt you've raged against quite rightly is that car testing uniquely ignores what most people actually need from a car.
Oh, yeah.
And I just love the absurdity of that. I mean, it's a bit like, you know, judging a hi-fi on its ability to wash your clothes. You know, it is utterly preposterous. The peak of it for me was around about 2004, 2005, I think it was. I was reading a story in Autocar, and it was a Volkswagen EOS versus that god-awful Focus convertible that looked like someone had just forgotten about the back of it.
Yeah,
you know, they just,
yeah,
we've done the front, sod the back, that'll do.
Yeah.
It just looked terrible. And the winner was decided. The last paragraph, it was, you know, a nail-biting decision at the end. Edge of your seat. And whoever wrote it, bless them, decided it on steering feel. I just thought, who on earth that buys one of these fucking god-awful cars?
That is peak road tester hubris.
But I did it. I did it.
But that's the thing. But it would be, they sort of go, oh, here's the new Megane Scenic. It's a bit twitchy on the limit. You know, what limit? What? I mean, because it's not, to take your stereo analogy, it's. I think it's more like, it's not asking the product to do something it's not designed to do. It's using it in such an extreme way that normal people won't. So it's sort of going, now this stereo is good, but it doesn't work on Mars. And you go, well, who cares? You're a lunatic if you're caring about that.
No, we used to, and we would just get lost. We were lost in our bubble. It was a great bubble to be in. It was probably the, you know, best fun working years of my life. I used to just arrive on a Monday morning, someone would give me some cash, and I'd just drive to some part of the continent, behave like an arse in a small car, and come back again. I loved it, but we were a bit lost in it all. Now, the Land Rover Defender, another vehicle that you're wrong about.
That was an almighty gear change there that you just made.
Tell us, you've got one of these things and you just adore it. And because I've got cars that I find it hard to justify as well. So tell us why you love this thing.
Oh, because it's crap. No, do you know what it is? I know this is real sound, I don't know, pretentious, or but it's almost like it's a palate cleanser, because I am lucky enough to drive lots of different cars in the course of my work and sometimes have to write about them. And as we know, particularly if you are talking about something like a Volkswagen EOS versus a Focus convertible, they're all broadly the same. You know, so particularly now, I think it's got worse, actually, all those SUVs. There's a Sniff Petrol story that I keep meaning to do. I just can't work out the construction of it, which is police are looking for an SUV, and it's been involved in a crime, and then they're struggling to identify it. Witnesses say they think it had a four-cylinder diesel engine. And the punchline is sort of, police have narrowed it down to 120 suspect models, you know. And so the idea's there, but I just need to sort of refine it.
You can see the artist at work here.
And that is the problem. And they're all broadly the same, and then sort of things do stand out because they're different, you know, like Alpine or whatever, but and they're more fun. There is nothing like the Defender.
But there's nothing like syphilis.
You know, yes, all right, there's nothing like being knifed in the heart. I know, we could go on. Yes, there's nothing like being in a Turkish prison for 17 years. But all right, there's nothing like it, but in a good way. Like, there's nothing like, I don't know, drinking tequila.
I think the reason why I get it, because I don't like them. I bought one new. Had a heavily romanticised notion that I'd own one from you and that my children would learn to drive in it. It'd be like a Labrador that stayed in the family for 40 years, and 7 months in, I just wanted to burn the sodding thing because I just could, you know, you couldn't get anyone in it really, and it wouldn't go around a car park, and it was just a pain in the arse. Then the Ford Puma engine broke, it wasn't like anything else. And weirdly, when people were in it, they were happy.
Yes, yeah. It's a happy car.
And their heads bobbed around, yes. and I really did enjoy that.
It's a happy car. Do you know what?
Yeah.
There are certain prime I mean, sometimes, and this is the thing.
It's happy it's, for how long, though? If it would, for, well, for 30 minutes, hour
no,
and
God,
a half?
No, God, no. I've driven mine to North Yorkshire. I've driven it to Manchester. I've been over to Wales.
By yourself or not?
Yeah, always by myself.
Yeah. the people in the back bobbing around aren't happy after about 25 minutes.
It's funny you mention that, because it is a bit of a solitary pleasure. And I haven't driven it. I hadn't driven it for a while.
Have you got a 90?
It's a 90, 90, yeah. 90. So they do sort of... They pitch and do the other one as well. They're just generally like... you know, dinghy in a storm. But we have, our family car now is a Jaguar I-Pace. So it's electric. So it's very quiet, very smooth. It has a nice ride. I've been driving around in that with my son, who's 5. And then he and I were going to a car show. And I said, well, we'll go in the Defender. This is perfect. Because I think I'm overselling it to him now. He's old enough to be wise to this. But I kind of sell it to him when we go out in the Land Rover. It's like, we're going on an adventure. And he does like it. Daddy's truck.
But he knows it's for you.
Yeah. So we haven't been out in the Defender for ages, and I haven't been out with him in the Defender for ages, and we set off, and I suddenly looked in the mirror and saw his little head lolling around. Well, not even lolling, like being whipped around. I suddenly thought, this feels a bit like negligence that I should not be reported to the NSPCC, because he's had weeks of this sort of smooth, futuristic, cosseted airbags and everything. And it's like, because when I ordered the Defender, I showed a picture of it when they announced those heritage ones. I showed a picture to my wife, and she just went, oh my God, that's the coolest car I've ever seen. I went, I know. She went, can we get one? And I went, well, now it's funny you mentioned that, because I was thinking, how am I going to butter her up for this? And but then she went, so do they do an automatic? She prefers an auto. And I went, no, they don't. She was like, oh, okay. Is it all right for the kids? How many airbags have it got? And I was like, oh, it's got none. Yeah. She's like, this isn't our family car, is it? This is for you. And I went, yeah, it's for me. But I'm still going to get one. Is that all right? She's like, yeah, whatever.
So. Are they still worth more than they were when they were new?
I believe so.
I think they probably are, yeah.
Oh, well, would you say
his is not, because he's done lots of mileage with it. You've got to put him in the garage and not use them.
I know.
That's the cool thing to do.
I bet yours hasn't done 10,000 miles.
It's done 8,000. So, and it's 3 years old. Three and a bit. 3.5. So, yeah. It's not. I don't do mega miles in it, but I do
will
use
it. Will
you
keep it forever?
I couldn't imagine selling it, put it that way.
Yeah.
Sounds really obtuse, but no, I couldn't. Whereas, you know, the other car, because I have an old Porsche 997 Gen 2, which I'm sure you want to bring up in a minute for one double clutched reason. And I could imagine selling it. I love it, but I could imagine just at one point I'll go, oh, you know, I'll chop that in for a 991
for a new, or for a new Defender that's coming.
Well, yeah, exactly. I know someone who's seen that new Defender, and I said, is it any good? And they just went, you'll want one. And I went, oh no.
I've heard it looks like a Discovery 4 with the wheelbase chopped out of it. That sounds quite appealing to me. That's what a Defender should be.
Yeah. Don't get me started on the new Defender, though. Oh. I can't bear to read people online talking about it because they're all getting it wrong. I wrote a column about this, but just like people going, I hope it's true to its roots. I hope you can hose out the interior. Like, who's hosing out the fucking interior of anything? You lunatic. The seats will get wet. Mine's got a stereo in it. I mean, what are you doing? Who hoses out the interior of their car?
People that get to cream after Christmas lunch.
No. Well, yeah. I mean, honestly, it'll have a star docked from the road test because it hasn't got three locking diffs or something.
Yeah, I know. That's the thing. I was just going, and it's like, but I can't remember if I did this as a story, but it's just, yeah, people who won't buy car want it to do things they'll never do.
And the great irony of the Defender, of course, is that the agricultural community that bought into it 40 years ago abandoned it for Isuzus about 20 years ago anyway.
They've all got L200s now, haven't they? That's the thing. Because I do people go, I hope the new Defender will be available in Welsh Farmer Spec. And it's like, Welsh Farmer Spec is an L200.
Yeah.
So let's just drop that romanticised notion of yeomanry that does not exist. Although, somebody told me a fantastic story about an old farmer up in North Yorkshire who, you know, one of those kind of classic farmers who's got a surprising amount of money, and went down to his local Land Rover dealer with his old Defender and went, want a new one of these? And they went, we don't make them anymore, sir. What's that? Oh, well, that's the new Evoque, sir, but that's a very different car. How much? Well, this one is top of the range, sir, and this is £45,000. That's all right, I'll have it. So he took it, and he bought the Evoque, and then he just started using it like a Defender, and putting bales in the back and all sorts of stuff like that, and it was holding up okay, but it was filthy. And one day he went down to the town, Ripon or wherever, and he went to the local supermarket. They've got a car wash, one of the old fashioned ones with roller brushes, and he's sitting in there having it washed. Looks down, there's a button down there I've never pressed. What does that do? Pushes it, electric tailgate goes up. Gets ripped off by the car wash, and he goes, oh bugger, and drives off. and the supermarket contact the dealer because the tailgate's got the plate on it with the dealer's name on it. And they go, yeah, have you sold a car registration? Yeah. Well, we've got the tailgate in our broken car wash. Could you ring the customer and ask them to come and get it back, please? We digress. But anyway, yeah, Defender. I do love my Defender, and I really couldn't imagine selling it. I don't know why. I live in London. I mean, it's absurd. I know that, and I've never taken it off road, which I know is laughable in a way. But that's not the point. I just love the way it is unlike anything else. That's the main thing. And it is a happy car. And one of the happiest things you can do in a Defender is on a lovely summer's day in the English countryside with all the windows down.
Hedgerows.
Yeah, I don't know why. I don't bother with the sliders at the back. And just mobbing it. Because you can absolutely mob them along as well, don't you find? Because they handle it. I'd love to find out. I kind of know why, because it's got a beam axle. So the tyres don't, they stay at all points, that they're always sort of upright to the ground. There's no kind of lean in them, and they don't have that kind of geometry. And so they corner in a really unusual way.
They have got quite a lot
of grip, but you've got no sense of where and when it might give up.
And the thing about anything with a ladder chassis is you're always busy because they don't settle in a straight line. You're always reacting to another input. So you're a bit Bo and Luke Duke. You're always like this. You're always doing something.
Mr. T quite, in the 80s.
Yeah,
why are you doing that?
Aren't you driving in a straight line?
No, that's the other thing, actually, it makes you drive it. Mm. You can't ever just phone it in. You're always busy because you're doing wheel stuff and you're changing gear and you've trying to maintain momentum, so you're always looking ahead. I know this sounds absurd, but I regard it as a driver's car because you have got to grab it and drive
with
it.
With this level of wistfulness, you could write for Autocar magazine.
I haven't even got onto how much tread shuffle it's got.
Now, before we finish this, I want to just ask you about broader question. The state of the motoring media and where it's heading, where we're at. I think it's a really interesting time for what we do for a living. I know that you have work outside of the awful world of cars, because you actually have a talent outside of this world. Sadly, most of us don't. But I think it's quite scary at the moment. I think there are some opportunities to be had, but there's a couple of big budget TV gigs going. That's not many jobs. And then there's some smaller budget telly out there. There's a whole load of noise on YouTube.
Yeah.
There's a thing called an influencer, which I know we've both got views on. And then there's the sort of the poor old magazine market, which just seems to be increasingly decimated.
Yeah.
I think the state of the magazine market is really sad, because I love magazines. I'm quite passionate about them.
Yeah.
And I suppose the sort of, like anyone that's incumbent, I find new arrivals a bit scary. I, you know, instinctively you just go, "Ooh, where did you come from? You're suddenly very popular. What's this all about?" So that's what happens when you're an old bastard, isn't it? I suppose.
Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, it's quite easy to sort of rail against the influencers, but the figures are impressive.
Yeah, they're undeniably good. Yeah.
It doesn't matter what I think or you think, because lots of people do like them.
Yeah.
So they're clearly doing something right, and it is a very different way of doing it. Because I have this little YouTube channel with my mate Johnny Smith, and it's just two blokes in a car talking rubbish, and we have, you know, really pitiful viewer numbers and subscriber numbers and all that, but we just do it because we like hanging out together and talking rubbish. But also, we now pay an editor to cut our videos, and I used to edit them, but I'm terrible at it. And I tried editing one the way an influencer would do, which is loads of jump cuts. It's basically just slap happy, just cut. You know, they don't finesse it. You don't use cutaways, as we call them, you know, other shots to cover cuts or anything like that. You don't try and match things in. Influencers are like one camera, and they just talk to it. And if there's a fluff, they just cut it out. Or they just jump cut it. And I tried doing that, because obviously that's a very efficient way, apart from the else, of editing. But I'm an old-fashioned telly head, you know. I was brought up, in the television world, and I've kind of worked in it on and off for 20-odd years, and I just couldn't do it. It was so ugly to me. And yet I know that it's obviously not putting people off, because millions of people sometimes watch influencer videos that are just jump cut, they're overexposed, they're out of focus, they're ugly, they're technically very bad, but it doesn't matter anymore. And I think, guess because everyone's watching it on their phones, and perhaps people aren't even watching all of it because everybody's quite sort of fickle, it sort of doesn't matter. It's just content. Get content out there. And it's like, you know, these influencers putting up one, two videos a week, maybe a video a day. It's a different mentality. And I think I'm just too old to do it. So it's you can criticise it. There's plenty to criticise.
Do you think you could do a series of videos entitled, "Should I Buy a..."
Yeah, well, I did too. Do you know I did a thing?
What was your character called?
He's I can't remember. He changed the name. He's called Ollie High Guys.
Ollie High Guys.
From the On the Rim YouTube channel, which is actually a slightly crude. No, in I should grow
on
up.
On the Rim.
I know. Well, that's the thing, because the payoff. So I've been meaning to do it for ages. It's a written parody of an influencer, and the gag, such as it is that it's sort of in one kind of 600-700 word
unbroken monologue, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a sort of written out monologue where it goes through the sort of five stages of an influencer's car, which is, hi guys, I'm thinking of buying this. Oh guys, I've ordered it, but what colour should I get? Oh, I'm in such, oh hey guys, my car's here. Right, this is the big one, I'm going to wrap my car. Okay guys, I'm selling the car. And rinse and repeat. And that's sort of how it works. So I just thought, I'll just condense that into it. And I've been planning to do this for ages. And then I just thought, no, I'm not going to do it because it just sounds like an old fart railing against something.
Yeah, that's my view as well. I don't want to sound like an old fart. But I also...
Well, I did do it in the end. Clearly, really well,
you know, I think, maybe you said it earlier on that, you know, the manufacturers and the entitlement now, you know, they're sort
there
of...
Is, it's creeping in a bit, probably. Yeah. But the you don't become an influencer without... A successful influencer without being quite clever. And one thing that I don't understand about a lot of the behaviour is that if you sort of create a routine around your work that means that you generate interest by buying a new car, it's pretty difficult to sustain that because you just got to keep buying new cars. You know, you've got to buy one a week. And I don't care how well resourced you are, that's going to become painful at some point. And also, I think the manufacturers are beginning to feel this, you begin to devalue the specialness of buying a car quite quickly.
Yeah.
And manufacturers really still want that to be quite special because you're handing over a large chunk of money
to main dealers. But yes, I know what you
but,
mean.
But you know, if you're buying a new one, it's a big special unveil of my car. But Wayne, you saw one 3 days ago.
Yeah.
I just think that's difficult to sustain.
You can see another influence in the back of shot also.
But I think what's interesting will be, because they're not stupid, these people. They're going to work it out soon enough. What are they going to do?
Yeah.
What are they going to do instead? Because they're going to do something, aren't they? To maintain the audience, keep growing their audiences. So I'm sort of sitting back waiting to see what the next move is.
Well, I mean, if you look at someone, there's a guy, Mr. JWW, who's sort of started doing more editorial, and he goes and drives old cars and he's not pretending he's bought them, he's just doing editorial. And it's quite interesting that he's shifted that way because essentially he's moving back towards
car journalism.
And fair play to him because I think, you know, he's doing a decent job of it. But I do wonder whether there'll be a little bit of the smart ones will, as you say, they'll figure it out because they obviously have. I mean, if you remember when influencers were sort of a relatively new thing in the car world, and it was mostly just sort of well-spoken teenagers / blokes in their 20s going around Knightsbridge filming supercars.
It was City Boys in their lunch break with a camcorder going, I quite like Lamborghinis.
Because I wanted to do a parody of that where it was just, I was going to walk around like where I live in Finchley, just like going, oh my God,
Astra Belmont.
It's the Splash Special Edition, guys. Oh my God, are those their 13-inch rims? Oh my God. Are those Halfords wheel trims? I think they are. And I never got around to it, but it has moved on from that already. And yeah. I mean, I would love to.
I think you still might have to do that.
Not doing much else than that.
You've got some good content ready.
I wanted to do as well, to parody where a lot of influencers are now, do a thing where, but it would involve me having to buy like an MG Montego. Which actually, they're probably like $5,000 now, so it's a bit silly to throw away $5,000.
Remember, I phoned you the other day, was it text message about buying a Prius? I was going to buy a Prius.
Yeah.
And I was going to do a big, you know, YouTube video, right, guys, big secret project. Should I buy it? It was going to be an 04 Prius. Because it sounded funny at the time. Your reaction proves why I shouldn't have done it in the first place.
No, I was encouraging you.
But I couldn't find a bloody Prius because they all get snapped up by Uber drivers. Yeah. I couldn't find one anywhere. But I thought that would be the way to approach that would be to try and find some ordinary cars and take the piss. But I think we're all a bit busy, aren't we? I think what I find really tricky is that when we were trying to be vaguely worthy and not too silly back in the day, someone like you came along and just took the piss out of us mercilessly. The level of narcissism that's going on in some of these
YouTube videos is,
yeah,
is sometimes I can't tell whether they're just taking the piss or whether they're being serious or not, but there's no one taking the mickey out of them. So you need to be doing it. You're the man.
I was going to do another one of those Ollie High Guys ones, just because the first one played so well, and basically I'm a shameless whore. I'll just do stuff that. And I did another, but prior to that, I did another sort of influencer one, which was more of a sort of a parody of the kind of mummy blogger thing. I can't remember what was that. The character calls like Xenia Biscafisca or something, and it was like,
yeah, yeah.
She's this. But it's
Xenia Biscafisca.
I think it was. I can't remember my own character's name. But and she's you know is being given cars to test. But
have you
knows
ever
nothing
had
about.
A journalist send you a legal letter because something was a bit too close to the bone?
Not a journalist. No, I had the only people who've ever sent me a legal letter are a well-known London estate agent chain. Who used to have minis that had distinctive liveries?
Really?
On. Yeah, and I did a. It was a picture of one of their minis or two of them, and they'd got sort of the standard, male genitals spray painted on the side, and one of them had a very very rude word written up the side of it. I think it said money grabbing, and the picture was cropped just before the last letter, and the caption was just estate agents. Real name regrets asking punters to design their new livery or something. And I got a proper legal letter from there. Yeah, really big sort of heavy-handed one. And I thought, I don't know why, because I'm usually a bit of a coward about these things, but rather than, because they went, we want to know who you are and give us your name and address and all this sort of stuff and blah, and I was just like, no they don't, they're just trying to scare me. So I just wrote, I've taken the picture down, bye. And they wrote back and went, that is satisfactory.
I worked I've for also, an estate agent did very you? Similar to that, and we had a meeting one day in Mayfair. And they said, look, guys and girls, just, you know, be sensible when you drive these minis. They've got the numbers on the side of them. And, you know, they're sort of, it's pretty evident that who they belong to. And everyone on a Friday all met for the meeting. And, of course, it had to be me, didn't it, that drove home from that meeting like an absolute lunatic. And got the call on the Monday morning. I got cut up on a Friday afternoon by this one with number X on the side.
Do you know, the other one, I just remembered this because it's the only other time I there was a bit of an unfortunate situation with the late Russell Bulgin, car journalist, who's a complete hero of mine, but there was, for various reasons, mostly me being a div, I wrote a story about him and he, there was a sort of some confusion, but basically he thought that someone else was writing Sniff Petrol and was having a pop at him, and it wasn't me, it was someone he knew, and he didn't like it, so I took that story down. But and that was all kind of fine. But then more recently, I wrote a thing. You know, there's an ongoing campaign to try and get the late John Surtees a knighthood.
Yeah.
When he was still alive, obviously. Yeah. It was going on for a while and people did petitions and stuff. And I just did this story about how it's saying, so John Surtees didn't want a
Why
bloody
did he
knighthood.
Never get a knighthood?
I don't know. It does seem unfair, doesn't it?
Was he having a pop on Princess Margaret back in the 60s and didn't know about it? Or what? There must be some reason why.
Well, I just did the story saying John Surtees doesn't want a knighthood. It would be a real inconvenience to have to get all my bank cards reissued, and he said. And then I got this email from his PA or someone saying, we've seen the story, this isn't true. And those aren't things that John would say. And I was like, I know, it's just meant to be a joke. But I was sort of like, oh, God, I don't want to upset John Surtees. He's a bloody legend. So I just took that story down because it was like...
When you have to explain the gag...
I know. Yeah. Well, it's like, oh, God, I forgot as well. I did one years ago when MG Rover was still around. I did a thing about how the whole of MG Rover had been put on eBay by desperate management. And I got a letter from one of their lawyers. I mean, it was an email. It wasn't like a full legal.
Asking you to bid.
It just... Yes. How much is up to? Is it £15?
The bidding ends in...
I think of all of them, we'll wrap up in a second, but of all of them, your greatest contribution, you're going to hate this, for me, to the motoring landscape was the Bob Lutz one, What is a Saab? When GM had bought Saab.
God, I forgot.
And this wonderful, you painted this picture of this board meeting at General Motors, an EGM, an emergency general meeting's been called to discuss General Motors' sprawling empire, and Bob Lutz, the figurehead, sits there and says, what is a Saab? Because they own it. This idea.
Do you know what's...
This far-removed parent company had no idea what a Saab was.
I loved it when Bob Lutz was high-ranking at GM, because, apart from else, the whole thing, when I set up Sniff Petrol, the problem was it was like, cars aren't inherently funny, and F1 isn't inherently funny. But what is funny is people taking themselves a bit too seriously.
Yeah.
An F1 is, particularly back then, very po-faced, sometimes a bit pompous. So that was kind of, the more seriously they took themselves, the easier it was. And so it's why you sort of, McLaren is an easier target than, say, Red Bull somehow, because they're just a bit more serious.
Yeah.
And the same with, you know, having a little go at car journalists who are sort of, you know, steely-eyed wheelmen, because they're taking themselves a bit seriously.
You know, that's me, basically.
Just give over. That's the thing people go, who is it? Who is it? And I'm like, it's a composite. It's not one person. It really isn't. But the Bob Lutz thing, he was another way to sort of try and get a gag out of it, because you could create this character that obviously wasn't really him, but was rooted in truth. So I think, because I used to do these stories about how he sort of used to threaten people with guns to redesign the glove box in the Chevy Captiva or whatever. And
you portrayed him as a kind of violent ex-Vietnam Tony Stark character.
Yeah, yeah. No, he's constantly got a cigar on the go. But there was one bit, I can't remember which story it was, but where he went home to get his jet fighter.
They used to commute straight to
the engineering offices. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And it was like when he left, it's all those things. And, you know, it's always like really useless F1 drivers. People are going, well, they shouldn't be in the sport. And I'm going, bloody brilliant. Yeah. Get some material.
Remember the story you wrote, the fake story about Eddie Irvine's pay packet? Because there was this story, wasn't there, that was, I thought it was apocryphal, turned out to be true, that one Ford family member was looking down the payroll and the fourth highest paid person was E. Irvine Esquire. And they'd never heard of him.
I didn't know that.
Oh, so you didn't write that story. That was someone else that wrote that then. Yeah. Sorry, I was attributing that to you.
No.
Right, we could go on forever. You've been an absolute sport. Thank you so much. I've giggled lots and lots.
Thank you, Richard.
Best of luck with everything. I hope we see you writing for a motoring show at some point in the future, because no one expresses cars humorously the way you do. I mean, some of the stuff you've written about them is brilliant. Enjoy your Defender, enjoy your I-Pace. You should have bought a Tesla Model 3. Enjoy
what?
The rest of summer.
Hang on, whoa. No, I shouldn't. Anyway, you can't yet. They're a while off, aren't they, right-hand drive? I think they're coming later this year.
Yeah, I might have
tremendous.
I might have a pop myself.
And actually quite well made.
Is it?
Yeah. Well, it's built by Austrians, isn't it? It's built by Magna Steyr. And Magna Steyr's job is building cars.
You don't want to go there. You don't want to say that. We can delete that.
We might need to do an electric
show. You're saying your fellow Midlanders can't build a car?
I'm just saying Magna Steyr build cars for the people, so it's in their interest to do it well, otherwise they will lose work.
Well covered. And on that note, tune in next time for another Collecting Cars podcast. But that's us over and out. Go onto the website now and see if you can find anything fun to buy.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.